Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to the Get Better Wellness Radio Show. Today is June 27th, and this is Erin Chamberlick, the Real Food Revivalist. Today we have a very exciting topic. We're going to venture into the world of, one of the topics will be one of the most effective ways we can eat to prevent and treat cancer. So not a small subject today. This is where we talk about, you know, real food. It just starts with real food. When we stop eating factory food that's loaded with chemicals and artificial ingredients and additives and preservatives, we open up the door to healing and weight loss. And even, we can make a huge dent in this problem we have of the runaway cancer epidemic. Not to mention the other epidemics of obesity and heart disease and diabetes. But the American Cancer Society has some statistics from 2012. It estimates we'll have 1.6 million new cancer cases. And, well, one-third of all cancer deaths, the American Cancer Society reports anyways, are linked to diet and physical activity. And while another third is caused by tobacco products. So what that says to me is there is huge impact that we can have if we just get a hold of the right lifestyle choices that we need to make. So this is a concern that's very real for many of us. Just briefly before we bring in our guest, for me, there was a time in my life when I was given a very scary diagnosis called lobular carcinoma in situ, and the surgeon immediately scheduled to have me on the table to take out an egg-sized lump, and I know what it's like to be standing there hearing those words and having the blood drain out of your face, but, you know, it's not about me today, but I will just quickly say that I scheduled that surgery, and then I went home and researched the diagnosis, and I just say thank God for the internet, because my research revealed that the surgeon was wrong, and I was able to get a second opinion, and I avoided, you know, surgery that wasn't even necessary. So anyways, I'm telling you there's power, and that you know more and can know more than you think you do, and that we have lots that we can talk about today in that subject. So let me bring in our guest today. I have Dr. Colin Champ with me. He's currently completing his specialty training in radiation oncology and has been published in many peer-reviewed journals, including the Journal of Clinical Oncology, which is one of the top oncology journals in the world. So he is very interested in the impact that our diet plays on the prevention and treatment of cancer. And so I can't think of a better person to be interviewing today. So welcome, Dr. Champ.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it. And I'm really enthusiastic about our talk today and hoping we could cover some important subjects out there.
Right. Well, I love social media. And as I was just reading my Twitter feed recently, I came across somebody talking about the caveman doctor. And that just got me interested. I'm like, who's the caveman doctor? I thought I knew all this paleo type people, and so I found you and your website, which is cavemandoctor.com, and I thought, I bet the caveman doctor isn't even a real doctor. But you are. You're an MD and an oncologist, and heading into a very important area, because you understand about nutrition in a way that most doctors do not. So can you tell me just how did this all start for you? How did you end up where you're at and as the caveman doctor?
Well, so this started a long, long time ago. Prior, really in high school, due to my older brother and my father, they always pushed sports. They pushed athletics, being active, and really watching what you eat. And I started this in high school, just researching, and of course at that point I was eating the conventional low fat diet. Then around college I started doing more and more research and seeing what worked for me. I started to find out what worked for me was somewhat opposite of what I was being told by my physicians and by the leaders in the field. Then I really started doing a lot of research on my own. The more I found was the more that these recommendations were just wrong. And at that point, I got very interested. I went to medical school to kind of consolidate my learning. And I almost went away from it somewhat. I went into oncology. I love oncology. I love dealing with cancer patients. It's a great and rewarding field. Definitely sad at times. And when I started this, I kind of went away from the nutrition because nutrition and cancer are very separate entities right now in medicine, which is very unfortunate. And then throughout my training, I started realizing that there are ways to kind of weave these two fields of nutrition and dieting and cancer care back together. And not only are they associated, they're intimately associated, and the two can't exist without the other. And unfortunately, in this field right now, they're very separate, and we need a lot of people out there to combine the two, and I'm really hoping that's what I could do. So,
right, I'm sure that it can be frustrating, you know, knowing what you know, and you did say that your research revealed that the recommendations we've been getting from, you know, people we thought we could trust are wrong. You know, the food pyramid was wrong. So
upside down.
So at what point, you know, as you're going through medical school and you know, coming to these realizations, you know, then you decided to come up with the Caveman Doctor. So how did you come up with that website?
So this was another backwards kind of way, but a lot of my friends and I, when we were working out in the gym, we found that cutting carbohydrates was one way to easily lose a lot of weight, especially cutting sugars, per se. And this kind of pushed me in this paleo-type direction. A lot of the Live and La Vida Low Carb, for instance, the Jimmy Moore site, he pushed low carb at first, and then he kind of has switched to the paleo-type lifestyle. And a lot of these paleo lifestyle look at this low-carbohydrate diet as a really efficient way to burn fat, and that really got me thinking. You know, this is directly against what everyone's been telling me, what I've been taught in medical school.
And
something is wrong here, and especially seeing all these patients where I'm telling them to eat less fat, eat more carbohydrates, decrease their calories, and exercise more, and it's just not working. And something has to be wrong, and luckily it is wrong. You know, we're not all that crazy. We're not that lazy and undisciplined. We're following directions, but the directions are wrong. And that really, really fueled me to figure out exactly why these directions are wrong and how can we fix them. And that led me right into the paleo caveman world, and that also led me into this thought process that our bodies have been eating the same kind of foods for 2.5 million years. So these are the foods that we're used to processing, and these are the foods that in myself I found that when I eat, I feel the best, I feel the most healthy, I lose the largest amount of fat. And from this, I just started suggesting this to my friends and my family, and I saw unanimously, I saw the same results. So I've just become more comfortable now promoting this to everyone.
Right. It's almost, you know, too good to be true. You mean I get to enjoy food that's delicious, and I'm not going to be hungry, and I'm going to get to my optimal weight and reverse major diseases. You know, it's like, wow, why haven't we heard about this before? And as you said, this is not what they're teaching in medical school, that you had to find this information on your own. And you know, as did I, through, you know, and all the people that are here, you know, with us now, figuring out that, you know, the information was wrong. We've been misinformed for, you know, the last 50, 60, 70 years. And so now you're the caveman doctor, like it or not, that people want to hear more from you. And so thankfully you're getting into the world of podcasts and blogging, because you, with your credentials, carry a lot of weight and people will listen. And that's why I'm really excited that you're here and that we are having this opportunity to hopefully get more people to know about you. So let's talk about what, you know, we're calling here the caveman diet. And, you know, no matter what your faith, if you don't want to go back millions of years, you don't have to go back that far to see that we have not been eating this way for very long. Even if you went back, you know, a couple thousand years talked about Bible times, we weren't eating this way. This wasn't the wheat of the Bible. It has been changed, and all the oils have been changed. And so is this, you know, it's not just a fad diet. We have been eating this way for a while. But how do we, you know, get so far from it to where everybody's sick and overweight now? Why is that?
Well, that's a lot of reasons, a lot of hypotheses there. A big thing was we pushed to make acquiring food and storing food a lot more convenient. And, you know, rightly so, a big part of our history, the history of humans, is acquiring food. You know, we started out as hunter-gatherers, and I think we just got a little bit too good at figuring out ways to have storable food or easily accessible calories. You know, we've replaced walking to your farmer's market, a lot of people driving somewhere to acquire food, and then coming home and cooking it to a two-minute ride to the fast food restaurant, getting 2,000 calories in you in a matter of 5 minutes. There's no work for it. And not only is there no work, but the reward, I mean, thousands of years ago, you spend 4 hours to get a piece of meat or to find some vegetables that are tasty, don't get me wrong, but now you spend 2 minutes to get a rainbow blizzard from Dairy Queen, and it's setting off crazy receptors and rewards in your brain where I don't think we can handle it. And it's a confusing message to our bodies, and it leads people very unable to know how to kind of combat these feelings and to combat these reward centers of their brains that are lit up from these food sources. I think it came from a good place, you know, 100 years ago or so, when we really started figuring out ways to get food to more people. But unfortunately, it morphed. And even you mentioned the oil production. On my podcast last week with my buddy Roger, he brought up the whole story about how these vegetable oils got introduced into our diet. And it's not one for healthcare. I mean, these were byproducts. They were feeding them to animals. They were causing issues with the animals that were eating them. They were causing a lot of health issues. So we figured out a way to kind of further process them to make them compatible with a human diet. And, you know, these were not health measures. These were financial measures, ways for these companies to use their byproducts to make money. There's so many reasons why our diet has gone south. And you touched on it too. People are less active. I don't think this is the major cause of the obesity crisis. I think it's more of a dietary issue. But people, you know, some people got less active. Some people have gotten more active. But it's multifactorial. There's so many issues here. And I appreciate people like you out there trying to figure out ways to combat all of them. It's very, very difficult.
Right. So often people are told, you know, you're just lazy and have no willpower. And you were touching on, you know, how these foods are lighting up the receptors in our brain, and that's equal to addiction. And people don't realize, they think they're going to Burger King for a Whopper with cheese, a shake, and large fries, and that they're eating real food and eating a meal, but in my classes, I walk people through, let's look at what we're eating here. You know, never mind the ingredients and the quality of the ingredients. Let's just look at how this food quickly turns into sugar because of the buns and the shakes and the fries quickly turn into sugar in your body. And your body doesn't know the difference when it's looking at a glucose molecule. But if you eat that meal I just described, well, not only is it 1,450 calories, but it's 1.43 cups of sugar in your bloodstream. And that is not the way our bodies like to operate.
Not at all.
So what happens when we eat a diet like that, dumping in, you know, almost a cup and a half of sugar into our bloodstream? What's happening, you know, with our biochemistry there?
Yeah, I mean, there's several things. There's, as we touched upon, the mental aspect, the psychiatric aspect of addiction. There's the next step where our blood sugar goes through the roof and our body doesn't know what to do. It secretes insulin, which is a hormone that lowers that blood sugar. It's looked upon by many as kind of a save-me hormone. It's a necessary hormone. But if your blood sugar gets too high, it can actually be fatal. So it is a save-me hormone, and it lowers that blood sugar. People often forget, where is that blood sugar going? And that's going right into our cells. It's going to get turned into fat. We're not going to use that for energy unless you're doing it during a huge workout or running a marathon or something. A lot of that's going to get stored. And then back to the psychiatric effects, when that gets stored, when it gets shuttled out of your blood sugar drops, and then you get hungry again. So guess mm-hmm. what? You're right back into that cycle, and it's painful for patients, and it's overload on your liver because the glucose goes to your liver, and then your liver is going to make triglycerides and other components of the metabolic syndrome, and it's a disaster. And you know, most importantly for a lot of patients, it's very anxiety provoking. You cheat 1 second, you eat one piece of bread, and next thing you know, you're hungry again, and next thing you know, the entire bread basket's empty. And nobody wants to do that. Nobody goes to a restaurant saying I'm gonna eat the entire bread basket and then feel bad about it afterwards. But it sure does happen a lot.
Right. And the thing people don't recognize, maybe they recognize they shouldn't eat meals at fast food restaurants, but if they go on the websites of the American Diabetes Association, American Dietetic Association, American Heart Association, they're going to see recommendations to eat a breakfast that would include perhaps cereal, skim milk, a banana, and a glass of juice, and that's doing the same thing. That's 40 teaspoons of sugar, and all of a sudden, you know, people are being told, oh, you have high cholesterol, go eat Cheerios. Well, they're not told that breakfast is the exact thing that's going to raise their cholesterol, not to mention their blood sugar. So, you know, all this is fueling our cancer epidemic, I believe. So what can a low-carb diet, you know, how can it be used to prevent or treat cancer?
So, yeah, this is a passion of mine, a great interest of mine, takes up maybe way too much of my time, but
ask a simple little question, and that's like a huge answer that could be a whole day seminar.
yeah, ask my coworkers. I babble on about this incessantly, just nonstop, and I think I drive them all nuts. But just as this diet makes sense for the healthy person out there, it makes sense as well for someone that has cancer, and there's several reasons why this would happen. So I'll try to keep this short because, yeah, once again, I could talk
Go
about
ahead.
This forever. But so first off, the low-fat, high-carbohydrate recommendations, these have infiltrated the cancer world as well. And I've just submitted a paper discussing this. About 50% of cancer recommendation or dietary recommendations for cancer patients push a high-carbohydrate, low-fat diet. The other half push just a high caloric diet because a lot of times we're scared that cancer patients are going to lose weight. But regardless, there's no low carbohydrate recommendations really made for cancer patients right now. And there's basically two issues where turning the food pyramid upside down and eating a large amount of fat while limiting carbohydrates has great potential. And one of these diets is a very low carbohydrate diet, and this limits carbohydrates to less than 50 grams. And this puts us in a state called ketosis. And for those of you out there that read my website, I talk about this often, and I'm not sure if everyone knows what this is, but it's basically a point where our bodies rely on alternate energy sources than carbohydrates or other things. And what we do is we burn our fat, and they turn into these sources called ketones, which are easily usable energy sources in our body. Now, relying on ketones instead of carbohydrates has several potential benefits. So the first one is you can starve a tumor. Now, a lot of cancer cells run on sugar. So the obvious kind of common sense approach is if tumor cells run on sugar, then just cut the sugars out. And there's, for those of you out there that have seen a thing called a PET scan, and a PET scan is what cancer patients get a lot, and it's basically a radioactive sugar substance we inject into the patients, and the cancer cells start consuming the sugar and take it up. So then when we put them under a scanner, the area that's taking up the sugar is radioactive, and we can see it, it lights up. And where your cancer cells are, they light up like Christmas trees because they are eating the sugar. This is what fuels cancer cells. So switching...
I'll just interject here for a second that there's our proof, the PET scan. You know, we see that cancer cells gobble up sugar. And then the question I always ask is, why do we have a candy dish on the reception desk at the oncologist's office?
Yeah,
you know, they know
nuts.
This, but somehow there's a disconnect.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's maddening to me. A gentleman, Dr. Eugene Fine, who's a nuclear med doctor up in Albert Einstein in New York, he saw this repeatedly with these PET scans, and he's actually running similar trials now, low-carbohydrate trials. Because how many times can you look at a PET scan before, you know, light goes off in your head and you say, wow, these cancer cells are surviving on sugar. Maybe we should start cutting the sugar out and remove the candy dish that you speak of.
Right.
It is frustrating.
It is crazy that, you know, it's the light bulb hasn't gone off for a lot of people before. But anyways, let's go back. You were talking about the benefits of being in ketosis and using that alternate energy source that, you know, and point one was that we could starve the tumor. So you pick up from there.
Sure. So, you know, the first one is to starve the tumor. And I actually am trying to run a clinical trial on this for patients with brain tumors because we have a blood-brain barrier which lets certain substances in and out of the brain. And if you actually cut your carbohydrates to a certain amount, you will theoretically stop all shuttling of sugar into the brain for the brain to use as energy, and instead it relies on these ketones. And ketones have been shown to actually increase efficacy of radiation, increase efficacy of chemotherapy. And also, if there's no sugar crossing the blood-brain barrier, you're only getting ketones in there, then your cells can survive on ketones, but the cancer cells don't. So it's a selective starvation of tumor cells.
Wow. That's
yeah,
really
yeah,
fascinating.
There's a lot of potential there, and there's animal studies that have shown this. Dr. Fine just published a study. It wasn't in brain tumor patients. It was any patients that is hinting towards this as well. And I would bet my money on this working in cancer patients. And I'm really trying to push it through, and I'm really hoping to get some funding to get this up and running.
Right.
A lot of potential.
Right. So. The eating this, you know, less than 50 grams of carbohydrates puts us in ketosis, and so the brain will use the ketones for fuel instead of the glucose, and cancer cells can't use ketones, so they're being starved while the brain is being fed. And this is also the beneficial diet for people with epilepsy, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, because of the same reason, right?
Exactly, because of the same reason. And these ketones are neuroprotectant as well, and that's why it helps these patients with seizure disorders. There's a lot of benefits here. You get a little bit of an increase in a hormone called cortisol too, and this helps because a lot of these patients we put on steroids. There's a lot of benefits here, and it's really hard to argue with at least pushing for clinical trials to assess this. Hopefully we can assess it and then let the data speak for itself.
Now, can I just ask you, you say you drive your colleagues nuts trying to talk about this. Has anybody listened to you? Do they see the light? Do they say that makes sense when you talk about, you know, doing this ketosis with, you know, especially the brain tumors?
They do. A lot of times at first they kind of, they look at me like I have four eyes, but then when I mention these, what I just mentioned to you about the brain tumors, it does spark a little more interest. And actually, I recently submitted my protocol to. There's a workshop that's American Society of Clinical Oncology, and I think the NIH funds it. It's in Vail, Colorado, and it is a clinical trial writing workshop. And I submitted it there, and they accepted me, so they're flying me out there
Awesome.
to complete the trial. So I'm happy personally, but I'm really happy because it shows that people are interested in this and people do see potential in it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Cool. Are there? I know we've hit on a lot of benefits. Are there other benefits of why a person with cancer would want to eat a ketogenic diet?
So a couple other benefits as well. The metabolic benefits are there too. So besides just the therapeutic value of ketones in a ketogenic diet, there's not great data in the metabolic benefits of a ketogenic diet in cancer patients. But if we look at the same risk factors for metabolic syndrome, which are the same risk factors for breast cancer recurrence after treatment, this is an area where we can maybe affect something. And basically, for the listeners out there, metabolic syndrome, it's also known as insulin insensitivity syndrome. And this is defined as obesity, mostly central obesity, so obesity around the belly area, like a beer belly. And it's in addition to high levels of blood glucose, insulin resistance, elevated triglycerides, and reduced good cholesterol, which is HDL, as well as hypertension. So there are all these kind of metabolic issues in there. And recent data is showing that these are also risks for, you know, not just heart attacks, strokes, et cetera. They're actually risks for cancer recurrence. And these are in breast cancer patients, so this is, you know, very different from the brain cancer patients that we were just discussing. And so what we've been doing is we've been looking in the non-cancer patients. Now, there's extensive studies looking at these metabolic risk factors and looking at the effect of a low-carbohydrate diet on them. A mentor of mine, Dr. Jeff Volek's, run a bunch of studies on this. And he compared low-carbohydrate, high-fat diets with conventional wisdom low-fat diets. And he's extensively looked at weight, abdominal fat, insulin levels, triglycerides. Another big one is inflammation. We all know about inflammation's connection with cancer, as well as cholesterol profile. And he's shown benefits in all of these with a low-carbohydrate diet. And, in fact, the low-carb diet's never been shown to be inferior to our low-fat recommended diet from up above the food pyramid, et cetera. And while we don't have trials looking in cancer patients for this, extrapolating from non-cancer patients, a low-carbohydrate diet has a lot of potential to increase, or to decrease, rather, many of these risk factors for cancer recurrence. And this is another area where we need clinical trials because there just really are none. We need to be open-minded about this, and we need to scientifically find out what's the best diet.
Right. And doctors need that to make moves. But we, the regular people of the world with cancer or wanting to avoid cancer, we don't need a clinical trial to tell us if it works. Just, you know, give me the box and show me where to play. I just want to get going. So if somebody's listening because they just picked up on that we were having a talk about cancer and we don't have but maybe 10 minutes left. So can you just outline, you know, and maybe we point them back to the Caveman Doctor website, too, for more information. But how should we eat? If we want to do this, we want to get into ketosis, how do we eat? Give us some specifics. Tell us what you eat and things like that.
Sure. So, you know, once again, just emphasizing that there's not great data on this, but you know, I generally suggest eating the same healthy diet that's healthy for someone without cancer. You know, the same diet that's going to decrease diabetes, it's going to decrease obesity, and going to decrease heart disease, probably is going to help with cancer as well. You know, the big things for me, I never count calories. I never, ever count calories. I eat a lot of animal sources of foods. This is another thing that kind of flies in the face of conventional wisdom. But when I do eat animals, I make sure they're raised ethically. I make sure they don't use antibiotics. I make sure they don't use hormones. You know, one thing to keep in mind, everyone out there, is if you're eating animals that are stressed and unhappy, you know, this they're going to be unhealthy, and it's going to translate to you. And if these animals aren't fed the foods that they're meant to eat, much like grains do in us, they're going to fatten these animals up as well, just like cows are fed corn to fatten them up. Well, just like if we eat corn, it fattens us up. But if we eat the animals that are fattened up, it's going to fatten us up too. So that's a big big thing for me. Limit or remove sugar. This is a hard one for people, but it's a big step in the right direction. And I don't eat any grains, and this is controversial. It's not controversial in the paleo world,
mm-hmm.
but I don't eat any grains. And all simple carbs, basically, I've replaced with vegetables, number one, so leafy greens, bright-colored vegetables, and then next off, sweet potatoes, and then finally fruit. And a good way to not go crazy on the sugar from fruit is I eat my vegetables about 3-to-1 over fruit. So I try to eat 3 times more vegetables than I eat fruit.
Right. That's good advice.
That's a big one. And then you hit on this before, but avoiding the processed oils. These things get oxidized. We don't have enough time to get into what that is, but they're basically they get full of free radicals, and you're just consuming cancer-causing free radicals when you're eating processed oils. So keep those out of your cupboard. Keep them out of your mouth.
And let's just list a few processed oils so people understand what they should be avoiding.
Sure. Canola oil is a very common one. Any of the a good thing is if you think about going with the caveman theme here, if you can kind of crush it and an oil would come out, like an olive, like a macadamia nut, those are generally your healthier oils. But if you're squeezing it out of a seed where there is no oil, corn oil is what we use in experiments to cause cancer. So it's really
Say
hard
that
to
again.
Ever.
You use corn oil to cause cancer.
We use it to cause cancer. I mean, it just carries in a bunch of free radicals with it. And these are oils that I cannot think of a time that should ever be consumed. And to cook with them is just crazy. So corn oil is a big one. Canola is that's Canadian rapeseed oil, I believe it is. Even like soybean oil, any of those things that are they're squeezing out of these crops that barely have any fat in them are generally bad ideas. Stay away.
Right, because if you take a seed or a piece of corn and you can't get oil out of it, then you're going to have to take it to a factory and subject it to high heat and hexane, and then it's going to be rancid and you're going to have to deodorize it. So it's basically all those pretty yellow vegetable oils in the clear plastic containers at the grocery store. So
Yeah. Eat
olive oil, macadamia nut oil, unrefined coconut oil, butter from free-range animals.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, the way they were eating, before we started getting all of our diseases. So eating vegetables more than fruits, avoiding processed oils, don't eat grains. You can do it. A lot of people do. Avoiding the sugars in their many forms. And are there other things that you can think of?
A big thing for me, you touched on this moments ago about the psychological effect, almost the addictive drug-like effect of a lot of carbohydrates. A big thing, a big psychological step for a lot of my readers is just to declare defeat. I mean, I declared defeat a long time ago, and just ridding myself of these breads and these simple carbohydrates to really rare, if any, infrequent consumption is just, it's made my diet and lifestyle so much easier. And for all of you out there that when you hear no grains, you think, no way, it's impossible. It's hard in the beginning, but over time, you feel better, you feel great, you lose a lot of weight. And it just gets easier and easier, and it makes you feel so good about your decision. So that's a big, big step. So I think doing that, number one, you will be thanking yourself in the future. Trust me.
Right, and, it's just, I've heard somebody in my class say, I just drew a line in the sand and said, this is how I eat. So you're not making the decision, oh, it's a bridal shower and they made these special cupcakes, maybe just today. That's where people fall down because they haven't drawn the line in the sand and just say, no, thank you. It's okay. We don't have to justify why. We just go around and hopefully they have a salad or some other real food and just saying, no, thank you. You don't have to explain yourself away. But, once we get rid of the bread, crackers, pasta, chips, popcorn, those kinds of foods, your addiction is what's talking to you now saying, I could never give up bread. That's the addiction in your brain. And it does take, about a week or two to break the addiction. But then you move through and all of a sudden there's new energy. You feel great. You don't crave as much. And there's things, that just slowly it'll just leave you and you won't think about it again because you're feeling so good.
Absolutely. I love the the negative response you get to when you wipe them out of your diet, and then every once in a while you go back and you eat that cookie, and afterwards you feel terrible.
Right.
And it's that reinforcement that my body is not liking this. Something is very wrong about this, and I need to not do it. And after a while, you just eliminate them. And I had the biggest sweet tooth in the world. And if I could do it, everyone out there can do it as well.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Me too. And I wouldn't be here today if I hadn't had some health stuff that got my attention. So if you are sick, if you do have a diagnosis, you know, you might be just praising it down the road when you say, if it wasn't for cancer, I wouldn't be where I am today and know the things I know today and helping people. And so that's, you know, the hope that you can feel better, you can get better, you can, you know, stop feeding your cancer cells and start feeding your brain and reverse things that people have said are irreversible. Get off drugs that people have said you'll take the rest of your life. It happens all the time when people start eating real food. Well, unfortunately, we're running up against the clock here, and I have lots of questions because I know you have several other burning passions that we haven't been able to talk about, like plastics and estrogens in the environment and how that plays into the risk for cancer. So I'm hoping that we can invite you back real soon, and we'll do a part two with the caveman doctor. How does that sound?
That sounds great. I think we have a lot more to talk about here, so I would love that.
Awesome. Well, Dr. Champ, thank you so much for giving us time this morning. I know you're very busy, and I certainly appreciate all that you've shared with us. We have covered a lot of ground, and I think given people lots of hope, lots of very specific things to do. So for more resources, be sure to visit my website, which is getbetterwellness.com. I have a 4-DVD series where I teach people how to eat real food, and we kind of unpack that food pyramid and that low-fat advice and show you the science of why that's wrong and give you some better ideas. So you could do that, or you can visit cavemandoctor.com and sign up to receive the blog post from Dr. Champ and go on iTunes and you know, search under his name, and you'll also find his podcast. So having said that, we have armed you and given you lots to think about and lots to do. So all right, well, we'll hopefully hook up here in the next, you know, couple of weeks, Doctor. And thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me on. It was great speaking with you.
Okay, you have a great day. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
Okay, everybody. Well, thank you for listening. And I know that you enjoyed that, and that's why I was hoping we could get Dr. Champ back to give us some more valuable information. Real food, it's powerful, very powerful. And if you are just learning about that, then please go on my website, getbetterwellness.com. I even have a link to a webinar that I did on reversing type 2 diabetes. And it's the same eating style. It reverses diabetes, high blood pressure. If you're overweight, have inflammation, joint pain, hives, fibromyalgia, anything that is bothering you is probably going to be greatly improved when you get off the standard American diet and stop eating processed food, especially processed grains in the form of pasta, crackers, chips, cookies, buns from the fast food store, French fries, potato chips, pretzels, foods that you have been told are healthy snacks, maybe are actually contributing to the problems that you have and your inability to lose the weight. So come back here, keep an eye on my web podcast listing, and you'll find out the exact date when we'll have Dr. Champ back. But I'm hoping it will be as soon as 1 to 2 weeks. Okay, everybody, thank you and have a great day.